Tonight from 10.
Phil Taggart and Alice Levine.
Now over on BBC Radio 1 Extra.
Mr. Jam.
Bringing you extra dubstep and extra bass. Turn up your speakers.
This is BBC.
BBC Radio 1 Stories. Discover more.
Hello. I am Stephen Manderson, better known to some as the rapper Professor Green, with you for the next hour here on BBC Radio 1.
And I'm going by the name of Emma. It's not my real name, but what we're talking about tonight is pretty sensitive for me, so Radio 1 are protecting my identity. I'll be sharing what drove me to try to take my own life a few years ago, and how I got back from that lowest ever point to being a happy and active 19-year-old again.
Emma's a suicide survivor. And suicide has affected my life too. 6 years ago, my dad took his own life. I've been left to deal with that and to wonder what made him do it, and also what could have been done to prevent his death.
According to official figures, nearly four under 35-year-olds take their own lives in the UK every single day. It's why suicide is often called the biggest killer of young people. Tonight, we'll share our stories and hear from other survivors and suicide experts. We'll ask what makes someone want to try to kill themselves and what more could be done to try to stop it happening.
It's a big and difficult subject and you might find it tough to listen to. Radio 1 have put a list online of charities and places to go to get help if anything you hear affects you. You can also call the Radio 1 advice line on 0800 110 100. It's free from a landline. If you think this is going to be too difficult or you've got young children around, there's also other stuff you can listen to at Radio 1 online. Let's get this started. This is Suicide Survivors with Professor Green.
Year on year, we see studies that show that young people's lives are ever more complex.
You have to find out who you are. You have to pass some exams or get into a job.
I never knew what to say about it. What do you say to a best friend about that? You know,
talking to people is important. The consequences of not talking and drilling yourself down into a hole, that gets serious.
I got to hear in this very room my mum and dad's experiences of what they went through.
Suicide is a very permanent solution to what's likely to be a temporary problem that feels permanent.
BBC Radio 1 Stories. Discover more.
Hello, my name is Stephen Manderson, better known to some as Professor Green. I am currently sat inside my recording studio in East London, where I have lived for the past 3 years when not on tour, making music. Here with me, I have Emma, and today we are going to discuss something that has affected both of our lives, suicide, which is forever a tricky subject. Hello, Emma. Welcome to my spaceship-esque little studio in East London. For those of you that can't see it, it has very weird textured silver walls. It's quite cool, isn't it?
Yeah, quite funky, yes.
How are you doing? You all right?
Yeah, not bad, thank you. Quite nervous, but yeah. Great.
Don't be nervous. Don't feel pressure. You'll make me nervous. But I guess we should start with how it affected you. How has suicide affected you?
Well, it's quite a long road to it, really. When I was younger, I was raped when I was 12. And I sort of had to deal with that. I didn't tell anyone about that. I sort of dealt with that myself. And it just got too much for me. And I tried to end my life when I was 16. I jumped off a bridge and, yeah.
Wow.
I'm here today, so
you are.
I guess that,
thankfully, yeah,
sort of.
You are. And you look very well.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Yeah.
Okay, see, for me, it wasn't something that I tried to do myself. When I was 24, it was on a Wednesday morning, my grandmother, who I lived with at the time, came into my room and woke me up. And I felt impending doom straight away as soon as I woke up. And it must have just been from the energy that she was letting off, you know. And she was in tears and she said, "Stephen, your dad's dead. He's hung himself." And they were the words that I woke up to. I hadn't seen him for 6 years. We always had quite a turbulent relationship. I loved him to bits, but he had his own issues that I guess he never really resolved. And he was always in and out of my life, which caused me great problems as a child. I was brought up by my grandmother, and to always want to just be told by that. You always, I guess, when you're in that kind of situation, you always you always want that person's approval, you know, and to not get it caused me a lot of problems as a child. And the last time I spoke to him was actually a year prior, and it was just before Christmas, and I reached out to him to get in touch with him. I hadn't seen him since I was 18, and he arranged to meet me the day after Boxing Day. I phoned him on Boxing Day, and I was sat at Burger King in Stratford for some reason. I think I'd gone to get a computer game with my then girlfriend. I asked him where we were going to meet, you know, are you going to come over? I didn't drive at the time. He did. He lived quite far out, so it was difficult for me to travel there. And he said that, oh, you know, I'll leave her name out, but that his wife and her children would be really, really happy to see me, and they were excited about seeing me again. And I lost my temper a bit, because it wasn't about me playing happy families. It was about me as an adult seeing my father and us resolving our issues, of which we had many. You know, we'd never really spoken about it, because as a kid I was always too scared to tell him how pissed off I was with him, because I was scared that he wouldn't come back. And he started stuttering, and I just said to him, if I ever see you again, I'll knock you out. And they were the last words that I ever said to him.
So you never spoke to him about the problems that he had, or the...
No, so I don't entirely know his story. And it turns out that, I mean, in the bits I found out afterwards, 2 years prior, his brother had committed suicide, and he had hung himself as well. There's also, I don't talk to my mum anymore, but I was named Stephen after my dad's other brother, who passed away due to a diabetic coma before I was born. And it wasn't until what happened with my dad that my mum said to me, well, you know, his other brother, Stephen, that they weren't sure about the circumstances surrounding his death. There is the chance that he allowed that to happen, that it was brought on by himself.
I'm Dr. Aaron Balick. I'm a psychotherapist, so I spend most of my time helping people come to understand what's going on for them, help them learn how to tolerate the kind of feelings that are coming up, and also to kind of, you know, get some techniques sometimes to deal with some of the more bothersome difficulties that cause these sorts of things.
I was really keen to have Aaron's involvement, because I wanted to speak to someone who actually understood the science behind it and the method behind why people do this and the steps that lead them to being able to do this, what the cause is.
I think the most important thing to say is that every single person will have their own unique story, and it's really important that people kind of honor their own stories, that there are sort of big line things that we can talk about that apply to most people who are going to have suicidal thoughts and kill themselves, but everybody's going to have a very, very particular story. And I guess some of those headlines, in a sense, are... Obviously, there's a correlation with depression. So people who are really severely depressed are obviously more likely to commit suicide. There's also some correlation with alcoholism. But we also need to recognize that because we're human, we respond to events in the real world. So things like not getting a job or being out of work for a really long time, the breakup of a relationship, the death of a pet, the suicide of somebody else, you know, anything that's going to be emotionally stirring that knocks somebody off their feet.
And I suppose any combination of those events as well.
Yeah, and sometimes people have really bad luck. You know, they might get four or five of these things, you know, in a row. Also, you know, things you wouldn't think of, like the holiday season, for example, when everybody's supposed to be happy and with their family and that kind of stuff, that's when we tend to remember the people that we've lost, and that can be a real kicker too.
Yeah, I can vouch for that.
Yeah, I think a lot of people will be able to relate to that. And when somebody dies, we already get a feeling that we don't get closure, that we haven't said everything that we wanted to say, or that we haven't been able to resolve anything. When somebody kills themselves and we're the survivors of that, we're left with all the questions that you're talking about. And that can include like really normal but not very nice feelings like guilt and anger and fury and frustration.
I felt all of those things.
Yeah.
All of those things. I guess initially it was the anger, because it was such a selfish thing to do. But me actually thinking that way was quite selfish, because I wasn't taking into account what had led up to him being able to do that. And I don't know what that is, and I never will. But I realised that, and then I was upset, and then it was never having had that chance to... For me, it was a big thing, because it wasn't just about not getting to say goodbye or not getting to say any one thing. It was the fact that I'd never really had him there throughout my life. And it made me realise how stupid not reaching out over pride was. I mean, my position was always that he was the parent, so he should be the one to fix things. But as you get older, you realise that even your parents are human, you know? They're not superheroes. And they have problems and issues themselves, and clearly he had problems which he never resolved.
You said something before about having feelings that you thought you weren't supposed to have, in a sense. And that's one of the things that happen around Christmas. It's like we're supposed to be happy. We're not supposed to feel bad or feel guilty or sad. And frankly, that's a time when a lot of those feelings do come up.
Yeah, it was weird. I mean, recently I got married and it kind of brought everything back to the surface again, because I was like, you know, my dad isn't going to be there to see it.
Yeah. So even those moments where you're happiest, you get that kind of
sadness.
Kick, don't you? Yeah. So even though you're kind of resolved a lot of it, that pain is still there, and that will carry on being there.
Yeah, it's a weird, I don't think it ever goes away. We went up to my nan's house the other day, and she was doing what she always does and annoyingly showing my now wife pictures of me as a kid, and out comes one with my dad, and I haven't cried in years, you know?
Yeah.
Look at me now.
Yeah.
Boo-hoo, you know? But I saw his picture and his face, and it just broke me down.
Yeah. What was that feeling that came up when you saw those pictures?
Just saw her. Just the void.
Yeah.
You know? The hole that is him.
Yeah.
You know, not having him in my life. That was my mate Ella Eyre with Deeper. You're listening to Suicide Survivors with Professor Green on BBC Radio 1. Before that, we were speaking with psychotherapist Dr. Aaron Balick about my dad's and my uncle's suicides and how those deaths affect me. We're also asking why so many younger people take their own lives. Just under 4 under 35s kill themselves in the UK every single day. Let's bring back 19-year-old Emma from Bristol. That's not her real name, as we're keeping her identity a secret. Can her story of her suicide attempt and then months of treatment and recovery help us understand what might drive someone to take their own life?
I'm Emma. Was raped when I was younger, and as a result of how that made me feel and what I was left with, the guilt, the shame and just the horror of it all, I ended up, well, making an attempt to kill myself, and I survived. Here I am today to live with it. I blocked out what would happen to my family. I couldn't think about what they would go through and, like, the aftermath, because that would have stopped me doing it. I know it would have.
Yeah.
It was a completely selfish thing to do, I must say. Like, nothing was going to stop me, and I knew that if I let any of what they would think into it, then I wouldn't be able to do it.
Yeah.
And it's just horrible thinking about, like, what they would have gone through. Even, like, I remember waking up in hospital afterwards and just hearing my mum, like, screaming, and my dad just, like, by my side, just crying. And that's even when they've got me, when I'm still there. And it's horrific to think what you'd leave behind.
One of the things that stayed with me for a while was I wanted to understand it. I wanted to understand why he did what he did. But I kind of worked out that actually, for me to understand what you'd have to feel like in order to do it, I would probably have to feel like that. And that's not a place that I'd ever want to be.
I don't think anyone can ever guess what it's like or even begin to imagine what it's like. I never thought it'd be something that I would do.
Was it something that happened quite quickly? Was it something that presented itself and you made a decision on quite quickly, or was it something that you sat with for a long time?
I did consider it a year before as well, and I thought, I don't know how I got over it, but I just thought, no, that's completely, you cannot do that. Don't even consider doing that. And then it was sort of 3 or 4 weeks leading up to when I did it. I went back to the same place like 3 times a week and just sat there. It was just crazy to think that you would go there, and I just couldn't do it. And then this one time on the day that I did it, I was just like, I can't keep doing this every day. Like, if I'm going to do it, just do it. Once you get the idea in your head, that's all you can think about. Like, you go to school, that is all you can think about until you do it, and until I did it.
Ever since it happened, it's been something that I've thought about a lot. So many things have gone through my head, like, is it entirely selfish? Is it because a person feels that's their only way out? I don't know. I mean, I guess it must change from person to person, depending on the circumstances, but I struggle to understand, and I don't think I ever will be able to, and I hope actually that I won't. It's just what it takes to actually make that something that you would seriously consider, as opposed to a passing idea of, I feel so down, I just want this to end.
It does become something which you have to do, even with mine not working and spending months in hospital and having to recover from the physical side of it. Even then, I still wanted to die. I didn't want to be here. I had all of that stuff from before, and then I had my suicide not working on top of it. That was just horrific, just having to deal with that, and that's why I got put in the mental health unit that I was at in Bristol. I just don't know what it is. Something just clicks. I literally found the meaning of life. I found that it's okay to be here, that I can actually make a life of myself.
The care Emma received that turned things around for her over 18 months was at the Riverside Adolescent Mental Health Unit in Bristol. A little while ago, she gave Radio 1 a tour of the building to get a taster of what life is like there.
When I arrived on my first day, I was absolutely petrified. I didn't really want to be here, to be honest, but this is the dining room where we have start of day. We, as a group, talk about how our evenings were and what we had done and how we felt during them and how we're feeling this morning. Also, in start of day, we sort of go through the day of what's going to happen, if people have lessons, if people have meetings with their therapy teams. And it's just sort of an outline of what's going to happen during the day. after start of day, we would have dance movement.
Chuck it around and see what happens. Up and down. Up and
up. It's a great way to sort of release all the energy, all the anger or sadness or any of the feelings that you've got. You can just release it through chucking balls everywhere or playing musical statues. That's literally what dance therapy is about. It's great to sort of just have some time out as well, to be able to enjoy yourself as well as release all those feelings that you've got inside you. It's a great way to scream and shout and just let it all out. This is the activity room where we can basically just chill out in an unstructured time. We've got a pool table and the table tennis and a whole cupboard full of games where we can literally distract ourselves from everything that we've got on and also have some fun with the other young people that are here. It's not all music and games, though. We went on from that part of the unit to a place I always found difficult, the family therapy room. Yeah, family therapy wasn't one of my favourite things about the Riverside. I got to hear in this very room my mum and dad's experiences of what they went through. Also, my sister has been to some family therapies where she has been able to voice what she experienced as well, and it was difficult for me to hear those things and see how it was for everyone else, but they're things that need to be shared and they had to be done, and this was a safe environment for them to be done. I dreaded the family therapy, I must say, because it was really, really hard. Just a few steps away on the same corridor, we're outside another room where there were difficult but probably life-saving conversations. It's the private office of my psychologist, Caroline.
Hello. Hi. Nice to see you. How's things?
Yeah, really good, thank you.
Great. Yeah. I'm Caroline Mercier, consultant clinical psychologist here at Riverside Adolescent Unit Bristol.
So much has been discussed in these... in this room, and I think one of my biggest memories was sitting here with a big piece of paper on the floor, just going over what is the meaning of life, I think. I think that was my main memory of being in here, sort of finding reasons to be here.
There are lots of challenges for adolescents, you know, and most adolescents, fortunately, are out there going through and going through life and negotiating those challenges very successfully. But, you know, you have to find out who you are. You have to pass some exams or get into a job. You have to sort out a different relationship with your family from being very dependent to being an independent adult. But I think as a therapist or as a clinician, you just hold that hope and belief that things can be different for them.
I really found my meaning of life here. I just found how I can actually cope and live with everything, how I could be okay with what I am and what's happened to me. I think Caroline has just made that all possible and made me be able to be okay with life, really.
You know, it's the person who does the work and I'm there to guide and support, really. I mean, I sort of use the metaphor of mountaineering, really. I mean, you might be showing them the way and helping them and stopping them fall down the abyss again. But, you know, they're climbing, they're doing it, and they get to where they need to go. It's lovely to see, you know, people who've moved on from here come back and tell us about what's going on. It really does make it worthwhile.
People here have guided me into seeing my future, so I want to own my own restaurant one day and actually make something of myself and become a world-renowned chef or something, but I would have never dreamt of doing that before. If you put the effort in and get the right help, things can change, and there really is a light at the end of the tunnel, and you can get back to the life that you deserve to have, and you can make something of yourself. Just don't make the same mistake I did. it's just amazing to see how far I've come. I cannot believe that I'm even here today, really. When I go back to Riverside, I go back there every few months and it just hits home, like, how far I've come.
But in a sense, that must be good memories. Although it was a hard time going back, there must be a positive thing there.
Yeah, like, I think for me, it's a great sense of achievement as well. Like, yeah, I've got through that. I've gone past that and I'm actually making a life for myself and I'm just 100% getting on with my life. And that's, it's still a part of me, but it's in the past. And I'm literally just loving just being here and being able to be okay with relationships and friends and stuff, and it all actually finally being okay, which is such a relief. It's just for me and all my family, and like, they feel proud as well. Like, I know they think it's amazing.
It's so good that you're able to feel that now, and you can hear it in the tone of your voice, and I can see it in the smile on your face.
Yeah.
You know, they're genuine feelings, and to have got to a place where you're able to feel that's incredible. Well done.
Thank you. Do you find it therapeutic to let it out in your writing, in your music?
Yeah, definitely. I think writing things for me helps me get them out of my head, where things spin around and get mumbled and jumbled. And I'm sure you know what it's like when your brain's racing, it's really hard to make sense of things. But when you put them on paper, it helps you get them out and you have something to look at and to analyse. Come on, Steve, and get to manning up. Something like Read All About It, which discussed less what my father did and more what the wife that he left behind did after he died, was scary to put out. To me, they're my actual life. When you put something like that out, they're then there for people to judge and pass comment on, and they're not just songs.
Read all about it. It's been a couple of years since your eyes closed. Why though? I used to want to know the answers, now why don't? I don't ever want to be where you be now. I already see enough of you and me that I'm frightened. What if I'm grown up to be just like you? But isn't that what all kids should aspire to? Even for all of this shit, I admired you. I could have drowned in a pillow I would cry to. All I ever wanted was a little time with you. But there's time I ain't ever gonna get now. How am I ever gonna get my head round this? When I get down, the whole world's grey to me. There isn't anything that anyone could say to me. I couldn't care less what people make of me. What they never gave to me, they can never take from me.
Sing, shout, scream till the words dry out. And all about it, sing, shout, scream till the words dry out, putting it on the news. Read all about it.
I definitely find it therapeutic. It definitely helps to no end. There's a lot of things that I've written that will never see the light of day, but have served me a great purpose. After putting out certain songs like Read All About It, you get messages from people telling you how much you've helped them through a time in their life, and you never expect anything you do to have that effect on people, ever. I mean, I find it really hard to respond when people say, oh, I really love your music, man. I get a little bit coy and shy. Someone says something horrible to me, I know how to respond to that. But when someone says something nice, I find it quite awkward. But cheers, yeah, thanks.
I had a heart to love, but both of my parents left me. And I found it hard to trust, made it hard for us. We used to argue and fuss a lot, always wondered when it was gonna stop. There were so many good times, so many bad. I couldn't hazard a guess what you remember me as.
I didn't have a voice, really. Growing up until I found music, I was never creative. I couldn't draw, you know, I still can't sing. But when I started writing music, it gave me expression, and it's a brilliant tool. And I think people should be encouraged to find things that they enjoy that can help them deal with other aspects of their life. Something that Mike Skinner said to me actually was that you should never not be worried about the songs that you're making, because if you are, then you're complacent. You should never be entirely comfortable. Something that I definitely took on.
In one single moment, your whole life can turn round. I stand there for a minute, staring straight into the ground. Looking to the left slightly, then looking back down. World feels like it's caved in, proper sorry frown. Please let me show you how we could only just be for us. I can change and I can grow, or we could adjust. The wicked thing about us is we always have trust. We can even have an open relationship if you must. I look at her, she stares almost straight back at me. But her eyes glaze over like she's looking straight through me. Then her eyes must have closed for what seems an eternity. When they open up, she's looking down at her feet.
Dry your eyes, mate. I know it's hard to take, but her mind has been made up. There's plenty more fish in the sea. Dry your eyes, mate. I know you want to make her see how much this pain hurts. But you've got to walk away now, it's over.
So then I move my hand up from down by my side. It's shaking, my life is crashing before my eyes. Turn the palm of my hand up to face the skies. Touch the bottom of her chin and let out a sigh. Cause I can't imagine my life without you and me. There's things I can't imagine doing, things I can't imagine seeing. It weren't supposed to be easy, surely. Please, please, I'm begging, please. She brings her hands up towards where my hands rested. She wraps her fingers round mine with the softness she's blessed with. She peels away my fingers, looks at me and then gestures by pushing my hand away to my chest from hers.
Dry your eyes, mate. I know it's hard to take, but her mind has been made up. Plenty more fish in the sea. Dry your eyes, mate. I know you want to make her see how much this pain hurts. But you've got to walk away now, it's over.
And I'm just standing there. I can't say a word, because everything's just gone. I've got nothing. Absolutely nothing. Trying to pull her close out of bare desperation. Put my arms around her, trying to change what she's saying. Pull my head level with her so she might engage in. Look into her eyes to make her listen again. I'm not gonna just leave it all now. Cause you said it'd be forever and that was your vow. And you're gonna let our thing simply crash and fall down. You're well out of order now, this is well out of town. She pulls away my arms, the timely clamp round her waist. Gently pushes me back as she looks at me straight. Turns around so she's now got her back to my face. Takes one step forward, looks back, and then walks away.
Dry your eyes, mate. I know it's hard to take, but her mind has been made up. There's plenty more fish in the sea. Dry your eyes, mate. I know you want to make her see how much this pain hurts. But you've got to walk away now, it's over.
I know in the past I found it hard to say. Telling you things but not telling straight. But the more I pull on your hand and say, the more you pull away.
Dry your eyes, mate. I know it's hard to take, but her mind has been made up. Plenty more fish in the sea. Dry your eyes, mate. I know you want to make her see how much this pain hurts. But you've got to walk away now.
Good to hear my old boss Mike Skinner in the streets on Radio 1. I'm Stephen Manderson, otherwise known as Professor Green. On tonight's Radio 1 Stories, we're asking what drives people to want to take their own lives. People like my dad, who killed himself 6 years ago when I was 24, and 19-year-old Emma, who's with us tonight. After months of hard work and support from family and professionals, Emma feels she is now able to cope with depression when it hits her.
Do you think perhaps if you had been made aware that it wasn't weird and it wasn't wrong to feel how you did, that it may have put you in a position where you wouldn't have gone as far as to try and take your own life?
Yeah, 100%. I think if me and my friends knew how to deal with it, knew that it was a bit normal to feel like this and okay to feel like it, then I think I would have seen other options rather than just that. People have to become more aware that it's something that happens to people. It's not something which is frowned upon and you've got to hide.
I guess it sounds selfish, but in what my dad did, it scared me so much it made me want to be more aware of how I was feeling and why I was feeling a certain way and to talk to people about it.
So again, we're back to talking again. I heard you say earlier, Emma, that after the rape happened, you put it away. When we put things away, they don't disappear, they come back. And I think both people in this room know that really, really well.
That was psychotherapist Dr. Aaron Balick, who's been listening in to our chat. It takes us on to the next thing we're going to talk about. Many experts think you can help prevent suicide simply by talking about it more openly to educate people about its dangers. In offices in Warrington, 25-year-old Alice Newton works for the youth suicide prevention charity Papyrus. She answers phones and responds to texts and messages from often desperate people who contact the charity's helpline.
This is the room where our advisors are all based. If we get a call, we will need to leave just because of obviously confidentiality and making sure that our advisors can obviously hear the caller.
People can call if they're feeling suicidal or if they're concerned about someone around them. It's one of the charities you can reach from the contacts page at Radio 1 Online and from the advice line, 0800 110 100.
We all answer Hopeline UK, how can I help? And they might say, I don't know. It's just that sort of gentle encouragement of getting them to build up rapport and get them talking, really, to let us find out what's happening for them so that we can help steer them in the right direction of support. The reason that they've contacted a suicide prevention helpline is because part of them does want to live. Sometimes I think people may think it has to be a huge traumatic event that has turned this young person's world upside down, when in fact it can be things that all young people go through, like the transition from primary school to high school, you know, having your first boyfriend or girlfriend and breaking up with them, things that lots of teenagers will go through. But it depends on whether they have the support around them to be able to get through those changes. That's the most important thing. The young person needs to have resilience. They need to have the skills to be able to cope with those changes.
If Alice could change three things to help stop young people killing themselves, what would those things be?
Encouraging resilience building amongst young people from a young age, that early intervention, if you like, of building up resilience. You know, letting young people know that, do you know what, life can be tough and you are going to go through difficult things, but that's okay. You know, just don't keep it inside, talk about it. And I think that is my second bullet point, to talk about our feelings, to say it's okay to have a cry if something's happened. It's okay to feel down, to verbalise, you know what, I'm feeling depressed today or I'm having a rubbish day. You're not minimalising the situation, you're just being open about it so that people know and can support you in that. The third one would be for people who are concerned about a young person to not be afraid that they can ask about suicide. The more we talk about suicide, the more we can reduce stigma. You know, there was a time when cancer used to be the C word, and at the moment, suicide is the S word. We need people to talk about suicide as people now do about cancer. How can you support somebody if you're not comfortable talking about it?
The Samaritans run their suicide prevention helpline 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They also run a program that they believe can save lives by teaching young people in schools about emotional health. It's called DEAL, short for Developing Emotional Awareness and Learning. The idea is to equip people when they're still young so they can handle problems that may come up later in their lives.
Okay, are we all sorted? You need a pen and a piece of paper, rough notebook, it doesn't matter, we're not writing anything for real.
At Presdale's all-girls school in Hertfordshire, Steve Turner is teaching DEAL to a class of 13 and 14-year-olds. He's just asked the group what might make someone unhappy or in need of support.
Think of something, it hasn't got to be real.
Right, if, like, your parents are binge drinking or something, and you're, like, really upset about it, and obviously they're drunk and stuff,
That sort of situation, yeah?
So my name is Joe Ferns and I'm the Director for Policy Research and Development at Samaritans. DEAL is a series of resources for teachers to use with young people, and they are aimed at improving people's awareness and skills about well-being. So it's about helping people to have good conversations, it's about helping people to cope with difficult things in their lives, and also helping other people to cope as well.
Right, so how are you feeling? How are you feeling today? There's the question. How are you?
I'm okay.
How are you?
I'm okay.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Right, the game changes now. Not allowed to use any word that's been used already. How are you today?
Great.
Okay. When lots of people say I'm fine, sometimes that isn't the whole truth.
Year on year, we see news reports, we see studies that show that young people's lives are ever more complex and that the pressures that young people are under are growing all the time.
If someone needs help, don't be afraid to help them.
Okay. Who's next?
I know that you shouldn't let a little bit of criticism from someone put you down because they're probably just criticising you because they're upset themselves.
One of the places that young people spend a great deal of their time through their teenage years is the school environment. And so it's sensible that we look to try to counter some of those pressures by making sure that we do everything we can during the school time to provide those people with support.
How have you been feeling over the last 6 months? Have you been up or down? Draw a straight line. It might be a curve, it might be, who knows? This looks like Blackpool Roller Coaster. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it goes up when me and my parents resolve a fight, and then it goes down when we're in a lot of arguments.
We would like to see more in the national curriculum around the issues to do with emotional health, lessons about coping skills or just conversations about seeking help. And so we would certainly encourage the development of the curriculum that prioritised the issue of well-being amongst young people.
Talking to people is important. The consequences of not talking and getting drilling yourself down into a hole, that gets serious, okay? At all costs, it's crucial that you keep yourself out of that hole by whatever means you can.
The whole thing made me feel more aware of other people's feelings and makes me think about how I treat people.
I think that it helped me to realise that there's always someone there for you, like, to talk to or for them to listen.
That I can talk to people and, yeah, if it does go worse, then I know what to do.
The Samaritans and two other mental health charities, Young Minds and Calm, the campaign against living miserably, have told Radio 1 they want more done in schools. Many say learning at an early age to recognise signs in yourself and others could save lives and should be on the school's national curriculum. In response, the government say they give teachers freedom to tailor their teaching because teachers know their pupils best. I'm going to take a quick break and have another lem sip. It's time for another song. This is Sampha with Too Much.
Too much. There's no need for us to rush this through. Don't think about it too much. This is more than just a new lust for you. Give up your heart's done. you tell me that you care, that you care. Don't give up when your heart's done and you tell me something's gone wrong. Wholehearted, wholehearted, you care. I know you care about me. You care about me. I know you care about me. I know you do. Oh, I don't think about it too much, too much, too much, too much. There's no need for us to rush this through. Rush it through. I don't think about it too much, too much, too much. Yeah, there's no need for us to rush through.
This is Suicide Survivors with me, Professor Green, on BBC Radio 1. We're moving on now. Some people think the threat of suicide is a bigger concern for one half of the population. Actually, my half. And your half if you're a bloke. A lot of the time as well, it's more difficult as a man because it's like, you have to be a man. You know, you can't just whinge and whine about your problems all the time. And something I became really good at was isolating my problems and not dealing with them.
It's probably not an accident that 3 out of 4 suicides are men, young and old men alike, find it really difficult to speak about their feelings. Doesn't necessarily mean that speaking about your feelings fixes it, because lots of women maybe feel more comfortable about talking about their feelings, but it's still, what feelings are they talking about? In what circumstances are they talking about those feelings? And are they actually resolving them? So it's really important to do the really hard work of going for the stuff that hurts to talk about, but to do that with the right people.
In case what Dr. Aaron Balick was saying there washed over you, there was a fact that you need to know. 3 out of 4 people who kill themselves in the UK, young and old, are men. The charity Calm believes this is down to expectations on men to be manly, to bottle up their feelings or to struggle on and cope with things on their own. So, we're in a pub now in Bewdley in Worcestershire, listening in on a chat between 2 old friends. 25-year-old Chris Coombs tried to end his life when he started at uni a few years ago. Here, he's talking to his best mate, Ed Birch. Looking back, Ed remembers having questions about Chris's odd behaviour in the weeks leading up to his suicide attempt.
Why you've been so quiet for so long, why you've not really spoken, why you, no matter how many times you try and make contact, you never really get it.
Yeah, it fell off a cliff, didn't it?
I just thought, well, that's uni. You know, we all both had our separate lives, and I thought that was the way it was going. And then it just seemed to, I don't know, it just seemed to get worse, really. It just seemed to quieten down, and didn't really hear much from you for a good 4 or 5 months.
No. I think I was isolating as much as I could.
Yeah, because I'd never heard from you. I didn't even know you were
That's
back.
That's right. Because I think you rang me a couple of weeks after that, after I was back down in Reading and went, where have you been?
Where have you been, man?
Yes. I was hiding by that stage.
Up to Christmas, university for me had been kind of salvageable. And then there was a big step, so it wasn't all the way to the bottom, but it was most of the way down. And then there was a spiral after that.
Where would you say it actually started, though? I mean, would it be the October when you got there, or...?
No, I've thought about this really, really long and hard. I can't put my finger on it. Now I'm much more... I don't worry about asking for help and saying, you know, things are wrong.
At the time?
Yeah, the time, you know me, fiercely, fiercely independent to the point of... Yeah, that look says it all.
I don't even have to say anything.
Yeah, you don't. Yeah. Fiercely independent and couldn't bring myself to say,
I need a bit of help.
Yeah.
Because you're independent, you're strong, you're doing your own thing.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily feel like you need the support networks because you're striking out on your own.
Exactly. I attempted not for any, you know, great life question, why am I here? You know, it was just, I am a failure. Mm. It was a great sense of failure and a tremendous sense of shame.
A shame that, for the outside world, wasn't there.
That's the thing.
And it's self-pressure in a new environment.
Yes. I didn't reach out, that word shame is important. I didn't reach out because shame was so all-consuming, and I think it's true for a lot of young men, particularly young men. I'm sure it happens to young women as well. That whole machoism, that whole expectation of what we should be. There is no other health issue that I'm aware of where there is a level of shame attached. Mm. Your shame kills you. Your shame, your anxiety, your pain, it kills you.
It's weird, isn't it? I never really thought about that, but it's seen as a strength, you know, putting a smile on things and keeping on top of your problems and not being what's perceived as being weak. But actually, on the other hand, being weak is actually not admitting to needing help or to having problems, and that's a huge part of what causes this in people.
It takes a huge amount of strength to ask for help when you need help. I mean, it's a hugely courageous thing. And you know, we were talking before about, you know, why does it have to become this extreme before people know? In a way, you know, it doesn't have to. Like, if you can get ahead of that, if you can get that awareness that this is, things are coming apart, I can't control it, I'm having these suicidal thoughts, get out there. And if you can, you got to advocate for yourself with the right people and say, I need you to care now, because it's going to get worse unless this thing doesn't get sorted.
Yeah, I think 100% what you just said about it takes so much strength to actually admit that things aren't okay and you do need help.
A reminder, if what you're hearing is making you worried about yourself or someone you know, head to Radio 1 online for links to charities and places to go to get help. You can also call the Radio 1 advice line on 0800 110 100. Calls are free from a landline. Back in that Worcestershire boozer, best mate Ed really wishes he'd known sooner that Chris was feeling suicidal.
I could have got my ass down there. I could have got myself down there. I could have stemmed the problem before it became a bigger one. I just feel that if I'd have had some, just that little bit of inkling that you know, something wasn't exactly swimming in the right direction, it would have been so much easier to have prevented.
I never knew what to say about it. Mm. What do you say to a best friend about that? You know, but like I'll put it this way. One of the reasons I didn't reach out to you and anybody else was that it wasn't okay.
There's quite a large stigma around it, though, isn't there?
There is a huge stigma around it.
And that's what makes it 10 times worse. You couldn't say to anybody that this is how I'm feeling, because the stigma that is around it, and you double your feelings of shame that, yes, that you've apparently failed, and that people now see you as a special
case. As the crazy one.
As the mad one and all that kind of thing. It just builds and builds and builds and just makes the situation 10 times worse.
I think, you know this, I still get depression. I will suffer from it. Suffer is even the wrong word. I will have depression for a long time, maybe for the rest of my life. But I can now, but you know, if you Facebook message me and say, how are you? I'm quite happy to say, actually, mate, it's a bit crap.
Yeah.
You know, I can reach out to you and say, look, here's how things are. I know I'm in a good place because I can now think about it in terms of, I'm glad I didn't do it. Because I didn't do it, university stopped, but I ended up doing hospital radio, I ended up doing choirs, I ended up working for the people I work for, you know, I ended up going horse riding again. I do all these things. So you can say, I'm glad I'm here.
Thanks very much to Ed and Chris for letting us listen in on their chat. A big thing we just heard, and something we've been talking about this whole hour. If Chris had reached out to Ed when he needed help, or Ed had known to act sooner on those nagging warning signs, Chris could maybe have got help before it got critical. Still with us tonight, suicide survivor Emma and psychotherapist Dr. Aaron Balick.
If we can hang out with people, or if we can have a society in which it's okay to talk about the things that hurt and the things that we're ashamed of and the suicidal thoughts that we sometimes have, there'd be space to talk about this stuff and we wouldn't have to shove it away so much.
If I just got help with it at the beginning and nipped that in the bud then it wouldn't have built up to become this massive thing that I couldn't deal with and couldn't talk to anyone about. It is just getting it at the beginning and being okay with talking about it. I think that's just the one thing that people need to be okay about talking about it.
It's a hard one, isn't it? Because I think I'm quite a worrier. I think I get that from my grandmother. Cheers, Nan. But it's always easy to think of the absolute worst that can come out of a situation. And when you start worrying about something that you actually have no control over because it's already happened or because you can't control whether it happens or not, and to not be able to stop that thought from running away and growing into this huge thing.
Yeah, I think it is about accepting that it's happened and you can't change that, but you can change the effect that it's had on you.
Thing is, you know, you say suicide or you say something like self-harm, people shut down, they get really scared, don't they? They're like, I don't know how to, blah, you know, I don't know how to deal with that. Still your friend. It's just somebody that's struggling. And the worst thing that you can do is shut down and freak out. And against all of that kind of will to be like, oh my God, I don't know what to say, just calm yourself down and listen. And if you want to ask that person if you think that they feel like killing themselves, then you ask that question because that's the reality of it and it needs to be talked about. To be the first person to kind of open that up with is a real gift.
And I suppose, not running away from it is the most important thing.
Yeah. I was the only one out of my friends who had ever had anything like this ever happen or ever felt like any of this. If they just knew what I was experiencing, like how to deal with that and, I don't know, where to go, then it could just be a different story for me.
This is Suicide Survivors on BBC Radio 1. I'm Stephen Manderson, better known to some as rapper Professor Green. We've been talking about my dad's suicide and how that's affected me. Dr. Aaron Balick has been here helping us through. We've also heard from Chris and Emma, who survived their own suicide attempts and now lead happy, healthy and active lives. Okay, we're coming towards the end of our time together now. I just wanted to say thank you firstly for being so brave and so honest, and for talking to me, a complete stranger, about something so personal. And also talking to you, Aaron, thank you. It's helped me understand more about the journey toward what my dad was going through in order for him to have done what he did. And it also, it better explained things that I'd already thought. So thank you.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you for giving me the other end of it as well. I think to get that insight into what it's like for the other parties involved, to see what you went through, and I've got a question actually. Does it make it harder for you that you didn't know why your dad did it? Or is that something that you've gradually come to terms with? Or
I've kind of had to come to terms with it. There's no level of kind of investigation that would ever give me that answer.
Yeah.
I think to hold on to that, to want to find that out would probably be really detrimental to me. And it's really easy to get caught up in stuff like that. I did for a long time, but I've got a life to lead. I'm married now and I want to have children and I don't want to make the same mistakes that my father did. So I don't want to get too wrapped up in worrying about something that I can't ever find out or understand. You know, I don't want anything to kind of detract from me taking from that what I need to become stronger and to understand that as well as I possibly can, but then focusing on my life and making better of it.
Something that stands out for me is, you know, suicide is a very permanent solution to what's likely to be a temporary problem that feels permanent. And that's the thing about it. It's the despair and the hopelessness and the feeling that nothing is ever going to change. And things do change. They always change. And to choose a solution that completely takes away the opportunity for any change, it's a real loss. And like both of you said, it's a loss for the people who go there and disappear, and for the people who are left behind when those people go. Life optimally is about confronting challenges, not about there not being challenges. That's the nature of living. So the better we can kind of talk about that and say, okay, here's another challenge, accept that as gracefully as we can, even so sometimes, you know, quite frankly, they really suck. That's life. So, you know, let's try and hold on to that in a sense. Things shift and move on. They're not permanent.
It's amazing to hear that so matter of fact and to be put in a way where it's so easy to understand because it's something so complicated, but everything that you just said made absolute sense.
Well, that's what I like to hear.
One last reminder, if what we've been talking about is affecting you or you're worried about someone in your life, you can call the Radio 1 advice line on 0800 110 100. Calls are free from a landline or go to Radio 1 online for details of organisations who can offer help and advice. This has been Suicide Survivors with Professor Green on BBC Radio 1. Thank you for listening.
thank you very much to Professor Green. That was an incredible documentary called Suicide Survivors. For more information, go to the Radio 1 website. It's Bill Taggart on BBC Radio 1, coming up after Newsbeat with Ben Mundy.
Listen, watch, share.
This is BBC Radio 1.